Khalifa regime. A reminder that the reverberations of what happened on Pearl Square in 2011 continue to be felt today.
There is a momentum for the revolution, that the crisis has not ended. It is there. It is escalating by the day. It's not really diminishing at all. And it is our feeling that the people will not give up unless there is a good degree of concessions. And my feeling also, the regime cannot do that.
This is what it looked like when the Islamic awakening reached the Kingdom of Bahrain 12 years ago. The protesters' main demands: socioeconomic justice and democracy. What they got from the regime, though, a state of emergency and a violent crackdown that lasted for months, aided and abetted by Saudi Arabia and the UAE. Many were killed or injured, many more jailed or exiled, making Bahrain a country with one of the worst human rights records. Yet none of that impacted its relations with the corridors of power here in the UK, which lists Bahrain as a core market for its arms sales.
The relationship that the UK government has is a special relationship because historically it has been an ally of successive repressive regimes. For a single purpose, well, a dual purpose. One is obviously the issue with regard to oil, and the second is the strategic importance of Bahrain. And what we've seen is a pattern of governments, successive governments of all political persuasions, put those interests, both strategic and with regard to oil, economic, above the basic civil liberties and human rights of the people of Bahrain.
The kingdom is also host to American and British military bases. Neither country offered any support for the uprising at the time.
Bahrain has an embassy in London, and the UK is one of four European countries to maintain an embassy in Manama. The participants here say it's time the UK government rethought its cozy relationship with the regime in Manama, held it accountable, and stood up for the people of Bahrain. Saeed Bourza, London.
In recent months, Alexei Reznikov has been mixing at the highest levels within NATO and the EU. He's just been sacked as Ukraine's defense minister amid a fresh corruption scandal. There was no mention of this at a press conference following a meeting of EU affairs ministers in Brussels on Monday. It was confirmed, however, that attempts are being made to apply more pressure on Russia over the war in Ukraine.
We continue to work on the 10th package of sanctions to be in place by 24th of February, 1 year after the invasion started.
EU taxpayers have already sent 50 billion euro to Ukraine. Ministers pledged on Monday to keep the money flowing. This as mortgage repayments in the eurozone are going up after the European Central Bank increased interest rates. Citizens have been talking to us about the cost of living crisis.
I bought my house, and so it's very, very hard to pay.
My weekly bill went from 50 euros per week to 100, 150, and I live alone. So
with 50 euros, you cannot buy some food for a week. You can just buy for 1 or 2 days.
It's several hundred, definitely. Several hundred euros per month.
More than you were paying.
Yeah.
The ECB is raising interest rates to try and control inflation, but it's damaging the EU's competitiveness. There's concern employment will be impacted.
Credit to the private sector is becoming more expensive. Bank lending to firms has decelerated sharply over recent months.
Analysts say EU sanctions against Russia are backfiring as higher energy costs spread throughout the bloc's entire economy. There is no relief in sight for mortgage holders in the eurozone. The ECB has indicated it will increase rates further in March. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Search and rescue efforts are underway in Turkey and Syria after two massive earthquakes rattled large swathes of the two neighboring countries and left thousands dead. Rescuers are digging through piles of the rubble to find possible survivors. But the freezing weather conditions is not only hampering rescue operations, but adding misery to those who left injured or homeless. Concerns are particularly high over the situation in Syria. The natural disaster has multiplied the tragedy Syrians have been going through for over a decade. The devastating quake brings to the spotlight how difficult life has been for millions of those who were displaced by foreign-backed militancy and endured Western sanctions. The crippling curbs have devastated Syria's economy to the extent that the country is unable to recover and reconstruct by its own. Now the same unlawful sanctions are complicating international efforts to assist Syrians who have been affected by the latest quakes. The World Health Organization says Syria's humanitarian needs are the highest, describing the situation as a crisis on top of multiple crises.
WHO recognizes Turkey's strong capacity to respond and considers that the main unmet needs may be in Syria in the immediate and midterm.
That assessment is echoed by other UN officials as well as rescue workers on the ground in northern Syria.
Those people already needed assistance. Now they will need more of that assistance, and they need an immediate earthquake-related assistance.
Honestly, the situation is very disastrous. It needs the interference of United Nations organizations and international organizations that are specialized in rescuing, because the situation is very harsh and people are still under the rubble from yesterday.
British activist Vanessa Bealey, who is now in Syria, says the Western sanctions could target anybody who comes to Syria's assistance.
The people who are now homeless are in the streets soaking wet and freezing cold without any alternative shelter and without any electricity, without any heating, without any fuel, because of course we don't have any heating fuel either in the country, pretty much. So these shortages, combined of course with the Western barbaric sanctions, including the CESAR law that was imposed by the Trump administration, which penalizes any country that even comes to the assistance of Syria, so those countries that can then be sanctioned by default if they come to the aid of Syria, which is, you know, a criminal sanctions regime to impose on any country and quite unprecedented.
Now the Syrian Red Crescent has appealed to Western countries to lift sanctions and provide aid to help the Arab country deal with the aftermath of the devastating earthquakes. The humanitarian organization has also urged the United Nations to facilitate the aid effort, particularly in the militants-held area in northwestern Syria. It says they are ready to deliver relief to those areas if militants open a road for them. The International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies said the quick-hit areas may need years to recover from the destruction. It says long-term help will be needed and not just assistance in search and rescue operation for survivors.
They'd warned the next one would be their biggest yet, and they have kept their promise. Tens of thousands of nurses from the Royal College of Nursing Union and ambulance crews on strike, this time together.
No nurses!
No NHS!
No nurses!
The chanting on the picket lines is not just about inflation-busting pay rises, but about the depressing state of the National Health Service. ICU nurse Neve has worked for the NHS for 10 years. It explains to us why she thinks the system is in crisis.
Total underfunding, a lack of foresight, I think, politically, and nurses really just being taken for granted for too long.
And that has meant tens of thousands of trained nurses either leaving the profession or working for the private sector in recent years.
They're calling out for the National Health Service to be kept alive, a system that is now on life support. And many in the medical profession believe that the deeper the crisis gets, the stronger the likelihood that privatization will be foisted upon them.
That's because while the NHS is at breaking point, private health care is flourishing, creating worries about a two-tier system, one for the rich who can pay their way, and another one, a subpar NHS for everyone else.
I hope that it isn't the case that we're moving towards a privatized system. I think it would be disastrous for all of us if that was the case. I think hopefully with these strikes, the public support that we've gained, the government will listen and see that that just isn't, you know, isn't an option. People don't want to lose the NHS.
If gestures of support by passing motorists is anything to go by, public support for the strikers is strong. It remains to be seen which side the British government will decide to be on. Saeed Pourreza, London.
The
The closing session of the ninth meeting of the Joint Economic Cooperation Committee of Iran and Zimbabwe was held in Tehran. During the meeting, the two sides stressed the importance of bilateral cooperation in the fields of agriculture, health, and facilitating exports of Iranian drugs into the Zimbabwean market. Iran and Zimbabwe officials agreed to use Iran's experiences in various fields, including the development of small and medium-sized enterprises, energy, and science.
Agriculture, exports of machinery, sale of petrochemical products, and technical engineering services are among the existing capacities for broader cooperation between Iran and Zimbabwe.
Speaking at the meeting, Iran's Minister of Cooperatives, Labor and Social Welfare, Solat Mortazavi, said that the current level of commercial and economic relations between the two sides should increase to at least $500 million per year, based on high potentials of the two countries.
The current level of commercial and economic relations between the two countries is not satisfactory, and the two countries should use their capacities to increase their volume of bilateral trade to at least $500 million per year. Zimbabwe has been under sanctions for almost 20 years, and Iran can share its experiences with Zimbabwe in various fields, including neutralizing the existing sanctions of the West.
Addressing the meeting, the visiting Zimbabwe's Minister of Foreign Affairs and International Trade, Makamura Shava, said mutual ties with Iran is taken to be very significant for Zimbabwe, stressing the country will definitely enjoy bilateral friendly ties with the Islamic Republic.
Zimbabwe and Iran are like twins who must learn to cooperate, because both countries have been slammed with sanctions by the West. And in this regard, the West hoped that Iran would go to its knees, Zimbabwe would go to its knees, but thank God this has not happened. So we are here to make sure that we turn the fortunes round and to say that these sanctions which the West imposed on us can be a blessing in disguise.
At the end of the meeting, several memoranda of understanding were signed by the two sides. According to Iranian officials, sanctions have become an opportunity to enhance production and improve human resources productivity, and that Iran is ready to transfer know-how and develop Zimbabwe's energy, transportation, tourism, medicine, and mining sectors. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Pakistanis take to the streets across the country on Kashmir Solidarity Day to condemn what they call the illegal occupation of Jammu and Kashmir regions by India. The rallies were held along with a host of events including conferences and seminars attended by senior government officials and lawmakers in such major cities as Lahore, Karachi and Islamabad. Kashmir Solidarity Day is marked in Pakistan every year on February 5. The day marks the nation's renewed commitment to the people of Indian-administered Kashmir. Participants in the rallies demanded the UN Security Council to implement its resolutions on Kashmiris' right to self-determination and end what they called the bloodshed in the Indian-administered Jammu and Kashmir.
Observance of Solidarity Day on February 5 is proof of Pakistan's continued support for Kashmiris. We will never accept India's occupation of Jammu and Kashmir and will continue our struggle for the independence of the Kashmiri people.
The purpose of celebrating the day is to renew the pledge that the people of Pakistan will continue to provide moral, political, and diplomatic support to their Kashmiri brothers and sisters until the independence of Indian-occupied Kashmir.
Kashmir, a Muslim-majority region, is divided into Indian and Pakistani sections, but claimed by both in full. The Kashmir dispute has led to several wars between the nuclear-armed rivals since Pakistan's independence in 1947.
The United Nations should play its role in ending the decades-long sufferings of Kashmiris who are struggling for their right to self-determination. The world should urge India to hold composite and meaningful dialogues with all the stakeholders to resolve the dispute.
Relations between India and Pakistan worsened in 2019 when the Indian government revoked Article 370 of the Indian Constitution, which granted Indian administered Kashmir partial autonomy.
Islamabad has long argued that Kashmir should have acceded to Pakistan because of its Muslim majority population. However, the court response from India in this regard has put the matter on hold. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
شانه به شانه سلسله کوه البرز وسعت نام تو وسعت نام خورشید جلوه خاک تو قرمز و سبز و سپید نمنم من نمن منم من ذره خاک وطنم من ذره خاک وطنم من ایران خاک دلیران ایران کنام شیران همیشه جاویدان.
This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy. Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite, words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me
in full in the days gone by. O the most merciful.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The International Atomic Energy Agency has made an announcement that is void of the truth. It's issued a report that accuses Iran of making an undeclared change at the Fordo nuclear power plant. Iran made an objection and clarified the issue with the IAEA, which the agency admitted it had made a mistake. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at how the IAEA has once again not only politicized Iran's civilian nuclear file, but has now resorted to making false allegations against the Islamic Republic's civilian nuclear program. Let me introduce Sayed Mohsen Abbas, who's a journalist and political commentator, joining us from London. Sayed Mohsen Abbas, welcome. So we're taking a look at this accusation in which, based on the IAEA, Iran had made an undeclared change to the interconnection, as it called, between the two clusters of advanced machines enriching uranium up to 60% purity at its Fordo plant. Iran has had a reaction to that, in which it said that the IAEA inspector's interpretation was incorrect, and then immediately, obviously, informed the IAEA on this. Why is the IAEA portraying this? First of all, why would the IAEA make a mistake? These are supposed to be professionals in this most sensitive of all fields.
Well, it's right to have a little laugh at these institutions, because they really have become a total joke and completely unprofessional. I mean, look, first of all, let's get the first fact on the table. In November 22, Iran actually sent a letter to the IAEA about the decision to do this 60% enrichment. Now, the JCPOA and all the other agreements are really pretty much null and void at the moment. There's no real reason that Iran should even be abiding by anything within that agreement. But even whether it's the non-proliferation treaty or the nuclear non-proliferation treaty that they're whinging about, the truth is Iran has no obligation to do anything on any of these issues. It's their magnanimity that they actually allow the IAEA to come in and essentially spy for their paymasters. Because, look, the reality is that these institutions, and let's come directly to the IAEA itself in answer to part of your question, Rafael Grossi and the like, their pay salaries ultimately come from the kind of sources which are all aligned to the Zionist interests. Inside their establishments, they have the United States of America's various officers all installed in there, probably Zionist ones as well, Israeli ones covertly. So they are completely compromised. These institutions essentially are an instrument of what one analyst has described as pre-aggression. What their purpose is to basically create scenarios which indict Iran, and then basically come up with false charges based on the scenarios they create. And then when they can't prove those scenarios, already they've put it out to the media. So there's an environment of Iranophobia which they've developed, and they want to use those false charges then to create aggression, to create conflict, to create war and a mood music within their own Western environments to justify potential unilateral action by the U.S. and Israel against Iran.
Isn't that just another form of lying? I mean, really, if you want to take a look at it in a simpler term. Anyways, what's more interesting here, and I'd like to get your train of thought, is the way that this was reported in the news, where it says the IAEA report seen by Reuters, IAEA Chief Grossi is concerned that Iran has implemented a substantial change. Then, and it came in drips. IAEA report seen by Reuters, IAEA informed Iran that its failure to declare the change was inconsistent with Iran's obligations under Article 45. And then the way the wires work, they come in with these drips. Say, Mohsen Abbas, maybe you're familiar. And then they issue a final report, of which they say the UN nuclear watchdog chided Iran in a confidential report seen by Reuters for making an undeclared change to the interconnection between the two cascades, et cetera, et cetera. First of all, maybe you can tell us, why is it that the IAEA reports that are confidential are being overlooked by a media agency by the name of Reuters, and then for it to be broadcast, of which Iran has said, what's going on here? Why are we getting leaks like that?
Well, very simply, put simply, the Reuters themselves, if you look at the history of Reuters, you'll see that they are a complete Zionist operation themselves. They have corporate Zionist masters and owners. They are run for the purposes of creating psychological operations, media propaganda, fake news, all geared towards supporting the Zionist Western Empire and their imperialist interests. The IAEA, therefore, are working essentially in tandem with another arm of that Zionist network. This is an intricate network which clearly has infiltrated virtually every major world institution, whether it's the WHO, whether it's the World Health Organization or the United Nations or the International Atomic Agency here, or whoever else overlooks the interests economically of the world. What you see is essentially a very carefully laid out set of, institutions which work for the same interests. And this is the thing that one has to understand. And that interest, the money mafia interest, the Zionist-led money mafia interest, its number one enemy is, of course, the Islamic Republic of Iran, because everything that Iran stands for, whether it's sovereignty, independence, its Vilayat-e Faqih political system, its desire to be, on its own feet, and its progress, its advancement, its rapid advancement in the science and technological fields and all others, all of this poses a challenge to the illusions and the veneer of actual systemic, goodness that they like to usually place in the camp of the Zionist imperialist kind of institution. The fact is that those are all being exposed by Iran, and the IAEA, the JCPOA, the nuclear issue is a major revealer of these realities. So what you've got is a synchronization. These things are discussed in the corridors of power, where the Israeli lobbies will be present, and they'll pressure and push a particular line. The state operators, the politicos, the media, and of course these other institutions, then will be all clicked simultaneously to do their particular job as and when required. And that's what you're seeing. It's all very synchronized.
Well, you talked about the Zionist regime. Of course, I'd like to find out from you what are we looking at when it comes to their participation, which they are very active, either in front of the camera through its very animated Prime Minister Netanyahu, or behind the scenes. Of course, the most recent being the visit by Israel Prime Minister to France. Interesting that France would issue anything against Iran on a civilian nuclear program in the presence of Israel, when it helped Israel to develop its nuclear warhead program.
Well, this idea of helping is a very important one, because it goes well beyond helping. They establish and root all of the kind of instability in the west of Asia, particularly through Israel. Israel is their primary frontline mechanism for creating division, creating disunity amongst the Arabs, for also threatening them with military punishment and other kinds of punishment. Israel is essentially the landing base for the Anglo-Zionist empire in West Asia, and it's the chief nest of conflict creation. And in this instance, what you're seeing is Israel, being exposed again, actually, because, it's an open secret that the Israelis have well over 400 or so Iranian nuclear arms, fully tooled up. I mean, and yet what we've got is an IAEA and America and the Atlantic powers focusing on an Iran that doesn't have nuclear capability as yet, and has said that it doesn't want it either, for that matter, and has gone into negotiations to try and create a situation where everybody can be satisfied, yet that's all being rejected. And yet there is Israel sitting right in that same region, the most nasty, the most brutal, the most torturing, undemocratic nation in that region. And that's saying something, given you've got Saudi Arabia and other despots in that region as well. There you have this particular entity, which is allowed to continue building this nuclear stockpile, and it is not subject to the non-proliferation treaty, the nuclear non-proliferation treaty at all. The IAEA makes no inspections of Israel and its kind of nuclear facilities. It doesn't even have the right to do those. And the US and the British and the French and the Germans make absolutely no noise whatsoever. But here are those same powers in Iran's situation. They've been squealing, basically saying that Iran is inconsistent with its obligations under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Inconsistent. What about Israel? I mean, and what about, for instance, Saudi Arabia, which the Americans have literally tendered American nuclear production companies, corporates, to come in and tender for contracts to help Saudi Arabia to become nuclear developed. I mean, the hypocrisy is profound. And of course, it's all based on the fact that Israel sees Iran as its primary enemy in West Asia and its primary, opposition to Israel's own Odin Yinon plan, which is designed to basically dominate the whole of the west of Asia from the river to the sea, as they say, from the Euphrates to the Israeli to the Mediterranean.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, it does sound like a broken record, but it really needs to always be brought into the conversation. So let's bring in John Bosnich, journalist and political analyst from Belgrade. John Bosnich, welcome. You know, the Israeli factor in Iran's civilian nuclear file has always been a thorn in the side of whatever blank you want to fill in. It's quite incredible because Israel is not a member of the NPT, but at the same time is receiving a cordial welcome when it comes to the IAEA. Where Iran is a member, and yet, as our guest there just indicated, the last statement coming from U.S. and the E3 is the fact that Iran is inconsistent, along with the language that IAEA has used. Why is it that a non-NPT member can have such influence on an NPT member and be received warmly by its aides or its allies?
Well, first of all, we have to categorize which non-member that is, and that's Israel. Israel holds itself out as an exceptional state, just as America does, the exceptional superpower. And therefore, both countries, which are allies to the deepest possible level, Israeli investments elect the president of the United States in most of the elections. So what we have here is a situation where two countries, which are actually self-declared outlaw states, which do not recognize these international tribunals, which do not recognize international bodies, have by themselves created an echo chamber in which one confirms the other and the rest of the world listens because they dominate the international media. So we're being fed an illusion here by parties which themselves have not only rejected these treaties and these rules, but which have flagrantly violated them. Israel is a nuclear superpower, not just a nuclear power. In its regional area, Israel is a nuclear superpower, and it is now threatening Iran and using its leverage in the United States to pressure Iran and to actually threaten war on Iran for what Iran has opened to public inspection via the organizations of the IAEA, which is, among other international organizations, infiltrated from the top to the bottom by representatives of, guess who? Israel and the United States. It's a closed chamber in which they want to dominate all power.
Some ask, why does Iran need a civilian nuclear program, John Busnich? Based on what statements were given by the head of the Atomic Energy Organization, Mohammad Islami, one of them is that he said just recently that Iran intends to generate 20% of its electricity via nuclear energy. That, on the one hand. And just today in our news, we had how he officially announced the production line of sanitary, superabsorbent, blood-clotting power, and the Essence microwave extractor. These are all medicinal uses of the energy, nuclear energy, and basically the civilian aspect that Iran is using to the fullest. This is something that is somewhat overlooked, especially for people who ask why Iran needs a nuclear energy program with civilian purposes. Why then would there be such pushback from the U.S. and from, of course, Israel and other, again, allies?
First of all, we have to put this all in context. The entire world is talking about global warming. Iran is a major petroleum product producer, and Iran is looking at a short-term elimination of its major revenue, which is from petroleum products. My own home country, Canada, has had a nuclear program since the 1960s. We have nuclear plants across the country. There is a nuclear power plant less than 1 hour's drive from my hometown. Nobody asked Canada what we were going to do with our nuclear power plants. Nobody asked us what was the rationale for us as one of the world's leading petroleum product producers out of our Western oil fields, why we needed nuclear power. And so let's, if we put this thing in context, why is it that Iran is asked to justify every action that it takes, which is simply a follow-on and identical to actions which have been taken by dozens of countries across the Western world? The difference, Iran is not an American colony, and we, the others, are. That's the difference. And if you were an occupied American colony, they would be pushing your nuclear power program. They would actually be suggesting to you that you get involved in their nuclear weapons research program as well. That's the way this world is run. It is not fair, and you are on the receiving end of the American empire and its Israel partners.
Mm-hmm. Simhassan Abbas, recently there was an occurrence that basically needs your breakdown as to the way it happened and as to the results that it got. And it was how the European Union was trying to push the IRGC, Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, to be listed as a terrorist organization. And they rounded up their MPs. They had a meeting about that. Of course, prior to that, lots of media hype about that. But it came down to the fact that Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said, listen, if you're going to go ahead with this, then there might be some question marks and maybe a move by Iran in order to move away from being a member of the NPT. And then we noticed not immediately, but very soon after, how they backed down from that stance. Well, why do you think that happened? I mean, what was the reason? Because that's not something that Iran has at least based on my memory and recollection, that it has said before. But then it showed what the reaction that came from the EU, basically backing away from it.
Well, I think the game is that the Western Atlantic Zionist Alliance basically wants to push Iran as far as they can. They don't want to push them too far, yet they are pushing their luck to the point where Iran is left with no choice. I mean, Iran has no real reason to abide by any of these international agreements and laws because it's up against an enemy, as we've just clarified, which has no regard for any of these rules and regulations. It had no regard for the rules and regulations when it assassinated Lieutenant General Soleimani and the extrajudicial killing of a diplomatic mission that was heading to Iraq. They didn't, no international institution followed up any kind of punishment for the Americans. The nuclear scientists that were regularly murdered by the Israelis, assassinated in Iran itself, I haven't seen any follow-up to that from the institutions that regard themselves as the paragons of justice and bringing nations to book. And so it goes on. This is a never-ending list where, you know, Iran itself it doesn't really need to abide by any of these laws or any of these institutions, because first of all, most of these institutions get their funding from the US. You know, okay. I can name and therefore they're all
very well.
They all have an illegitimate.
Sorry to jump in. I want to give 1 minute to John Busnish under a minute. Sorry, say Mohsen Abbas. John Busnish, even in US's national security assessment and report, it came out that Iran is not after developing nuclear weapons. And that has been stated time and again. But at the same time, we notice the politicization of Iran's nuclear file. Are they aware of the inconsistencies when it comes to Iran? And what is their ultimate game plan moving forward, or your projection down the line here? In less than a minute, please.
Yes. Well, they absolutely are aware and are designing all of their dispatches, all of their information as a propaganda war against Iran. There is no doubt in my mind that Iran is a military target of Israel and a military target of the United States because they simply want to control every country in the region. I suggest that you continue to abide by the agreements that you've signed and continue to develop your civil program, as you've said to the public, and to defend yourself in international institutions as best you can. And with God's help, you will survive and succeed.
Thank you, John Busnish, journalist and political analyst. Say Mohsen Abbas, thank you for your contribution, journalist and political commentator from London. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Vitahway and the team, it's goodbye.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Numerous states throughout the U.S. witnessed a sharp rise in the number of homeless and deaths of people experiencing homelessness in 2022. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned, please. Due to the lifting of eviction moratoriums put in place at the outset of the COVID-19 pandemic and the soaring prices in the cost of living, the ranks of the homeless and those living in precarious conditions are swelling, putting tens of thousands at risk of a premature death. According to the Becker Friedman Institute at the University of Chicago, 500,000 to 600,000 people in the U.S. experience homelessness on any given night. Approximately one-third of them sleep on the streets. The strong winter storms over the last 2 weeks and extreme weather throughout the year made environmental conditions deadly for those living unsheltered and in substandard housing. The recent storms that battered the eastern half of the U.S. have claimed the lives of nearly 60 people, some of whom were homeless and found in snowbanks or in vehicles. One of the homeless victims, 57-year-old Charles Wilson Legion Jr., was attempting to make it home to his family in Tennessee from Louisiana on foot. He was found by hunters in southern Mississippi, frozen to death. Many homeless shelters saw a sharp rise in the number of people they served in December 2022 due to the harsh winter conditions. It's very worrisome. We know people die in these conditions, Beric Patton, communications manager for Night Ministry, a Chicago nonprofit that shelters nearly 6,000 people experiencing homelessness, told The Guardian. Warming shelters have become places of refuge for the homeless, but many of them do not open their doors until the temperature drops to 32 to 30 degrees Fahrenheit, already dangerous considering that hypothermia and frostbite can set in at 50 degrees. The National Weather Service warned that last week's cold front could see temperature drops of 20 degrees or more in just a few hours. Kyle Knudsen, the Social Services Director at the Salvation Army in Corpus Christi, Texas, told local news station that nearly half of the 43 official homeless deaths in the city this year were the result of cold weather. However, the winter weather this year was only one of a number of causes of death for the homeless. In many cities, the death count was higher than in previous years. Causes of death in addition to exposure to the elements include overdose due to substance use, homicide, and treatable health conditions. December 21st, 2022 is recognized annually as National Homeless Persons Memorial Day in the U.S., a tribute to those who have died while experiencing homelessness and whose lives and passing might otherwise have gone unrecognized. Vigils were set up around the country in communities large and small to remember those who lost their lives this year. On the West Coast and throughout the Midwest, records were set in the numbers of deaths of homeless population. In Seattle and King County, Washington, more than 270 people died in 2022, the highest number recorded in 20 years, ranging in age from 2 to 80 years old. According to Newsweek, December 2022's winter storm saw U.S. citizens frozen to death in their cars and fallen a street side in snowbanks. According to economists at the University of Chicago, more than 500,000 Americans experience homelessness every day. But there are just over 300,000 beds for homeless people. That means just 2 out of 3 homeless people across the U.S. can find temporary housing. The remainder are literally unsheltered. While making up 12% of the country's population, California now accounts for 30% of the homeless population, with the U.S. Department of Housing and Community Development estimating that over 172,000 residents experienced homelessness this year alone. California also saw the country's largest increase in its homeless population over any other state. In Southern California, recorded deaths among the homeless population in San Diego County increased over 7% from 2021 to a total of 574 deaths, up from 536 last year and 357 the year before. Ventura County, northwest of Los Angeles, saw 158 homeless residents die in 2021, while Santa Barbara on the Central Coast lost 38 in the last 2 years. In San Francisco, over 200 people died in 2022, many from accidental drug overdoses. Last April, the Los Angeles County Department of Public Health found that nearly 2,000 homeless people died between April 2020 and March 2021, marking a 56% increase in deaths compared to the previous year before the pandemic began. In Maricopa County, Arizona, the death toll has also risen for people who experienced the homelessness. The more than 700 people who died without permanent shelter in 2022 represented a 42% increase over 2021. Another 450 people could be added to that figure, although local law enforcement has not determined whether those people were homeless. Lisa Glow of Central Arizona Shelter Services told 12 News, "We really are at a crisis. The lack of shelter is leading to those increased street deaths. We've even had babies die in the street. A lot of seniors dying on the streets." The number of deaths of homeless people increased in Denver, Colorado metro area as well, with 263 total recorded last year. However, local agencies state that these figures are incomplete due to the incomplete record keeping. Other cities in Colorado also saw increased numbers of deaths, mostly due to sub-zero conditions, although some were the victims of violent attacks. Many of them were in their 40s. Others died due to opioid use, especially from the use of fentanyl. The U.S. capital, Washington, D.C., recorded 77 homeless deaths in 2021, but this figure does not account for additional autopsies that remain to be completed by the medical examiner's office, which has a 90-day delay in reporting. According to the Washington Post, D.C. appears to be on track to exceed the 100-death mark after recording 180 deaths in 2020 and 138 in 2021. A study conducted by The Guardian and the University of Washington found that from 2016 to 2020, the deaths of people experiencing homelessness in the U.S. rose by 77%, representing at least 18,000 deaths. Regardless of the location of death, a clear fact remains. The life of the average American is seen by the capitalist ruling elite as dispensable, expendable, and holds no value except when it can be exploited for profit. The explosion in the rise of homelessness itself has been caused by a multitude of factors. Millions of Americans have been pushed to the brink of or directly into the path of impoverishment and ruin by the bipartisan attack on living standards and social programs over the past 40 years. Successive bailouts of corporations and banks overseen by both Democratic and Republican administrations, of which the burden of paying for them has been placed on the backs of the working class. The countless sellouts and betrayals by the rotten corporatist union bureaucracies, trillions of dollars spent to build up the military and wage endless wars, which have given way to the US-NATO proxy war against Russia in Ukraine. The ruling class's disregard for human life is most naked in the handling of the COVID-19 pandemic, where Trump openly threw caution to the wind in terms of a policy to fight against and contain the spread of the virus. Biden rode in on a wave of popular optimism that he would follow the science if he were elected president. as the last few years have proved, the Biden administration has done nothing but keep this promise declaring the pandemic over while eliminating public health measures, such as enforcing lockdowns, requiring the wearing of masks, social distancing, and quarantining those who are sick or exposed. The consequences have been the official deaths of over 1 million people in the U.S. and over 20 million worldwide, and even such ghastly figures are widely known to be vastly undercounted. The fight for justice is bound up with a fight for access to social rights, which include housing, employment, education, healthcare, and basic necessities. This must be waged as part of a larger fight against militarism, war, capitalism, the source of all inequality and want.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.